Hayes, and you're listening to AM 1500 KSTP. From the high desert in the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening, or a good morning, as the case may be, across this great land and well beyond, covering commercially an area from the Hawaiian and Tahitian island chains, eastward all the way to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good morning, I'm Art Bell. All right, first I should warn everybody, I'm sick. I've got about 100.5 temperature tonight, and this stinking, rotten, miserable, you know, I wish I could use other words for it. Flu has returned. And I thought I was going to get away with 4 days of a temperature. And, you know, I appeared to be better Sunday, and so went on the air Monday, and here I am Tuesday. And I tend to get kind of punchy when I get have a temperature, and I have a temperature. So this show tonight remains tentative from moment to moment. As you know, Ramona's also very sick, so it's everywhere, and otherwise it might be actually a pretty good topic. I got this. Sacramento area-based hospitals are filled to the gills with very sick patients. This comes from the Bee. Forcing them to close their emergency rooms from time to time and scramble for extra staff. County medical officials have declared a state of emergency in response to unprecedented hospital overcrowding and have implemented a disaster control system to distribute ambulance patients to hospitals that can handle them, not necessarily where they want to be taken. Bruce Wagner, chief of emergency medical services for Sacramento County, said, quote, "We've never had to do this before," end quote. At one point recently, 9 out of 10 hospitals were closed to any new patients, Wagner said, leaving UC Davis Medical Center the sole destination for any ambulance patients. On Monday evening, 2 emergency room beds were available countywide, and 30 patients were waiting on gurneys for any bed to become available. Now, I just read you this one, published the 13th, but I could read you millions more just like it. CNN is now reporting they have identified a second flu that they're calling the Sydney flu, I think, courtesy of those down under. So that's where it is, and whether I'm going to make it through the program or not tonight, I think, is a tenuous bet at best, but we'll see what happens. I'd also like to welcome WICO in Salisbury, Maryland, and they're 1320 on the dial in Salisbury. Welcome to the network. Glad to have you. Wish that I was well, and it was a cheerier welcome. In a moment, as promised, former city councilwoman Frances Emma Barwood is here, and she had a big news conference and a big announcement earlier in the day. In a moment, you will hear about it. All right. This is the first time ever you're going to hear this ad, and it's going to be for one night only. The Sea Crane Company is the first company in North America to offer the new Beijin wind-up lantern. Now, listen to me carefully. The Beijin wind-up lantern, now people have been anticipating and waiting for this for about the last year. They've done a lot of stories on CNN and so forth and so on. The wind-up lantern, regularly $74.95, on sale now for Valentine's Day delivery at $64.95. Basically, here it is. You wind it for 30 seconds, and you get 4 minutes of light. You also get 2 hours of light from the built-in rechargeable batteries. You get a spare bulb and an AC adapter all included. There is a 5-year warranty on this lantern. It is made of yellow high-impact ABS plastic, has a sleek, modern design, and you are the first ones to have it offered to you. And this is a historic occasion tonight. So order now for Valentine's Day delivery and save $10, plus, of course, you get free shipping. So the new Beijin wind-up lantern. If you want one, call Bob Crane in the morning at 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. I've been telling you about Snappy for some time now. It is, if you're into computers, as I absolutely am, a must. If you have a PC computer or a compatible, and you don't have Snappy, you don't have a complete computer system. It's only $99. Now, what is it? Well, it is about the size of a pack of cigarettes. It plugs into your computer's parallel port where the printer normally would plug in. It then accepts any kind of video, camcorder, TV, VCR, doesn't matter, any video, moving or still. And when you want to create a computer picture in one of about 7 formats at least, a TIFF, a GIF, a JPEG, whatever, it actually is technically a GIF. I've always called it a GIF. I don't know why, and I still do that. And the amazing thing is the new 3.0 software, well, it's all amazing, puts a video screen on your TV. And when you see the picture you want, you click your mouse, boom, and Snappy renders a high-quality, high-resolution, still photograph that you can put on websites. You can turn your home movies into a family album on computer. You name it. Now, if you want to see Snappy, go to www.play.com or go to your favorite computer store and grab one up, he says, avoiding the obvious, a Snappy for $99. All right, Frances Emma Barwood. Most of you should know who she is. She was a city council woman in Phoenix, and she has done many, many things, but from our perspective, the events of March 13th are what, of course, I am fairly interested in, as well as the concept of open government in general. And Francis had the tenacity to go into a city council meeting and simply ask what that giant thing over Phoenix was. And now we had Linda Moulton Howe with a couple of new witnesses last night. So, as you well know, a gigantic object was seen over Phoenix. Francis simply asked, hey, what was that? Could we find out, folks, what was over our city? And, of course, then she was subject to intense ridicule from mayors to governors, a recall election. Life was a little rough for a while, but she stood her ground and defeated those who would have defeated her and finished her term, and now is announcing that she is running for a higher office. She wants to be the Secretary of State of Arizona. Now, this is a particularly interesting position in Arizona. And has led to the governorship in more than one case. So this is a very, very serious candidacy. And here is Frances Emma Barwood. Frances, welcome.
Hi, Art. How are you?
How am I?
I'm good. I can hear.
Yeah. I'm pretty sick, Frances. Anyway, forget about that. I'll live, probably.
I hope so.
Francis, I'm going to have to ask that you get real close to the phone. You don't have two phones up, do you?
Okay, no, I'll do it. I'll be better.
Okay, yeah, you got to really just yell into that phone. Francis, when did you decide that you were going to run for the Secretary of State's office?
Well, actually, last January when I said I was not going to run for a third term on city council, and I said at that time that I would probably run for Secretary of State. And then, as you know, over this last year, it's been real interesting. I didn't realize there was going to be so much turmoil, both with asking that question and the recall election. So it's been kind of interesting, and it really opened my eyes to an awful lot of things. And I was told that I should just quietly, you know, find some place and go away. And I decided that's the problem with an awful lot of things these days. And so I decided that I would still go on with my plans.
Okay, you told me some things earlier tonight we are not going to repeat. However, I think it's fair to say there is a lot of pressure for you not to run.
Yes.
Is that fair?
That is pretty fair.
You are going to, I know that your co-campaign manager is Steve Bassett. And
right.
We all know Steve very well.
And Steve is here.
And he's right there, right. How much of your campaign is going to embrace the concept of open government of... Let me even back up. Let's go back to the whole March 13th fiasco. And if you were now the Secretary of State of Arizona, or had been, no, let's just say if you get into office, Francis, what will you be able to do about initiating some, you know, kind of action to find out what the hell did happen March 13th? Will you be in a better position?
Well, absolutely. Secretary of State is the second highest office in the state of Arizona, and it is a very pivotal part of the state. You know, as a city councilwoman, I asked and, you know, was kind of slapped down because all I was a councilwoman.
Right.
Secretary of State could have, you know, much more influence on asking for investigations on things like this.
What would you do as Secretary of State? Could you literally order an investigation?
No, I couldn't order, but what I could do was to both work with the governor. And hopefully whoever ends up being governor would also, you know, be amenable to you know, doing this. But, you know, I've been one where if the governor wouldn't be, I'd still, you know, I'd go to the news media and say, you know, this is something that needs to be looked into.
Oh, I know you. I'm sure you would.
And I think it's really important. I've spoken with so many people that, you know, it is mind-boggling. First of all, how many people saw whatever this was that traveled 400 miles over the valley.
The flares?
Yeah, right.
We had a couple of other witnesses on last night that have never come forward before. And what's happening now, Francis, is a lot of people who were scared to death to come forward are now beginning to all come forward.
Well,
and a lot of them are telling stories that go well beyond just a craft.
True. And tonight I received a phone call because, of course, this was on the news today, and a very prominent person. And, you know, he was real nervous about telling me his last name because he didn't want to have to divulge who he was.
Right.
And I said, you know, it would be just for my use, you know, just so that I have it so I know you're a legitimate person. And what he described to me was, again, absolutely incredible. There is no doubt in my mind that it was something phenomenal that traveled over Arizona. And for the life of me, I can't understand why, you know, the government just doesn't look into it.
Well, I've heard that you have said earlier today, if the government did it, let them do it again.
Right. If it was, it has to be one of three things. As near as I can figure, it could only be one of these three things. One is that it's something the government did. The second would be a hoax. And the third is something unknown from someplace else. Whichever one of those three, you know, the government needs to let us know.
If it was some kind of black government project, Francis, it's hard to imagine any motivation for putting a craft or seemingly putting a craft over one of America's biggest cities. I mean, Phoenix is the area, I think, is 2.something million.
2.2.
There you go. 2.2 million people. I can't imagine the motivation on the part of the government for doing something like that.
It would be kind of a shame on them if that's what they did.
Yeah.
Because whatever this was traveled only over the most densely part of the valley, from way north of Prescott to south to Tucson, and was very obvious. I mean, it was in a time of the evening where most people are out in Phoenix at the time of that year. And, you know, whatever it was being obvious. It wanted to be seen. It was seen. It was something really phenomenal. If it was a government craft, you know, why were they being so obvious? And let's see a reenactment. If it was a hoax, I want to know how they did it. And if it was something else, then the government needs to say, hey, we don't know what it was, but obviously it was something.
Mm-hmm.
But to go and say, you know, we're not looking at it, we aren't interested, it's just really hard to believe.
What is the reaction that you get in Phoenix? Now, I understand there is a lot more to your... in fact, I have your position statement here. And there's a lot more than UFOs and the March 13th incident that you're running on.
Right.
However, I think it's fair to say that the people of Arizona, specifically of your district, felt that the issue, no matter what the mayor and governor said, was important enough that they turned away your recall election. And I'd accept your judgment on that, but in fact I'll ask, do you think that was the major issue that contributed to your winning that recall election, that people were angry about that?
Well, it was probably a combination of things, but I would say that by far the majority of people that I've talked to, well into the 90%, want to know why government isn't at least dealing with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it bothered them a lot. I took a lot of harassment and a lot of ridicule. And, you know, it just seems like if people are so afraid to ask the government questions, especially people in the government, this is scary.
Yeah, it means we live in a different kind of place than we used to.
For sure.
So, you're going to begin actively campaigning now?
Yes. Today was the kickoff. You know, the formal announcement. We filed the papers. And I've got, two campaign chairmen. One here is Joan Payne, and she is a right now Mesa City Councilwoman who is in the end of her last term, and we think alike on so many issues that it's really kind of scary. And Steve Bassett, of course, is going to handle the issues with government not being open with people.
Now, you're running for a very high office, and the ridicule factor is probably going to come into play.
Not only is it because it's a high office and because I'm taking on something that people would rather just not discuss or government would rather just not discuss, but I'm also taking on some very high money people that have been, you know, a kind of power structure in the state for a long time, and it's going to be very interesting.
Again, referencing the great pressure you're under right now without detailing it, Francis, if you don't respond to the pressure you're under to not do this, which obviously you haven't because it went unannounced, if you don't cave in, what do you personally think will happen?
Well, that's going to be, you know, I wish I knew. But I'm hoping that the majority of the people of Arizona do feel the way that an awful lot of the people I've talked to feel, and that's that we need to have openness of government. You know, it's become a them against us attitude, And that's pretty sad. So we need to get back the way it was back, you know, when I was a teenager in the 50s.
Sure.
Where we, when they said, we're here from the government, we're here to help you, it was a good thing. Now when you hear that phrase, everybody kind of gets real nervous.
That's right. Go help somebody else.
Right.
But again, do you think there might be, how can I put this delicately? There might be any reason for you to be concerned for your safety if you plow ahead.
Well, Art, as you know, I'm a very strong proponent of Second Amendment rights. And, you know, I can very well take care of myself.
So well, that's I guess that's a good answer. What do you expect to be the largest obstacles, and how many people are you running against?
Right now, I am a Republican, and I'm running against a very established Republican-appointed incumbent, because, as you know, we've had many shakeups in our state government, and the last three or four Secretary of States have seceded to the governorship, and we've lost some governors, and as my sister put it, I don't want to move to Arizona. They eat governors for breakfast.
They really do.
They kind of. So, you know, I'm up against a very heavy political machine, and everybody says, oh my goodness, you know, of all the ones to go up against, it's going to be really difficult, and I realize that. But I think, you know, I could have gone back into the private sector and you know, probably lived a nice, quiet life. I really have had a real hard time being able to accept the fact that government has kind of gotten to the other end of its people. And instead of being the people as the government, it's become, you know, the government rules under any circumstances.
That's right.
And don't question.
That's exactly right. All right, stay right there. I would like to get a sense of how the news conference went. A lot of Arizona media, of course, were present for her announcement, and it's going to create much of a stir in Phoenix, believe me. So here you've got it, Frances Emma Barwood, running for Secretary of State of Arizona. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Kingdom of Nye. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Now, here again is Art.
Once again, here I am. 800-557-4627. It comes from Great American Products. All right, back now to Frances Emma Barwood, candidate for Secretary of State of Arizona. Frances, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, his phone is
better?
It's a little bit better. We'll talk about that in a second. Let me first ask you, how did the press conference go? Who showed up, and what kind of questions did they ask?
Well, I think it went pretty good, and what we had was definitely two different groups there. One was people that were interested in having some of the questions answered about what has been going on over Phoenix.
Right.
And the other was groups of people that I have been very supportive of in the past, both constitutionalist and Second Amendment people and veterans. And so it was quite a mixed group. And I think that they all agreed on one very main issue, and that's that we need to have openness of government and truthfulness in government.
In the first half hour, your phone was so bad that it was not broadcast quality. I mean, I had to amplify your voice to a point where there was a lot of noise with it, Frances. That's how bad it was. And you said something to me during the break as I had you switching phones. You said a phone man came to your house to check the lines. Now, Did you call this phone man to check your lines?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
I had assumed that a friend of mine did, because I was having some interference in my line, so I just assumed that he did, and they were checking it out. And when I talked to him, he went, "Did you ask for identification?" I said, "No." Did he tell you who he was from? I said, "No, I really, I just assumed it." And so now I'm really starting to question.
Francis, the phone company does not do that. As a matter of fact, it's hard to get them out. And as a matter of fact, generally, if you complain, they will determine whose fault it is these days. And if it's your fault, not the fault of the line or some other problem within the phone company, you've got to pay an extra service charge. That's the way it works these days. They don't come just offering their services. If I were you, I would have your house swept.
I'm intending to do that, and I feel really foolish because I'm usually not that careless. But, it was kind of a hectic day, and I just had, the friend of mine happens to be a security person, and he just about had a stroke that I didn't even ask for an identification.
Good for him. I would have had a stroke, too. I bet you've got a bug in your house.
Well, we'll find out, I'm sure.
There are lots of attitudes to take about that, but if you want to strategize, if you want to protect your information until you are prepared for it to be out, then I really suggest you get a hold of a professional, and I'll talk to Steve about that here in a moment, and have him sweep your house, because I'd almost lay money that you've been bugged.
And I guess that's a possibility.
Yeah. All right, Francis, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to talk to your co-campaign manager, Steve Bassett, for a moment. And Francis, I wish you well. It's a gutsy thing you're doing. I don't know where it's going to go, but I know you, and I know you're going to carry through with it, despite the pressures that we can't talk about right now.
Yeah, it's I've never been one to back down on anything, so... it's going to go through, and we're going to have a pretty exciting year and lots of fun.
Well, what the hell? It's only one life, right? One life to live. Might as well live it up.
Yeah,
all right. If Steve Bassett is there, Francis.
I'm getting him. He picked up the extension.
Yeah,
I
picked up, yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm going to hang up.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Good, Steve. You're good and loud here. I don't know if you heard what I just said to Francis.
Yes, I did.
I really, the phone company does not come and offer to simply check your lines. That just doesn't happen, Stephen.
Well, I suppose it's always best to be prudent.
Yeah.
You just never know about those things. I think that anyone that gets in this field for any length of time, from time to time, thinks about that. But I'll be honest with you that if anybody truly wants to know your business and they have the resources...
They're gonna know.
They're gonna do it, and so I just pretty much conduct my affairs as straight as possible. I advise the people I work with to do the same.
They can bounce a laser off a window pane now and listen.
Yeah,
to what I'm saying.
You start worrying about that,
I know.
You drive yourself crazy.
I know.
These kinds of games, this is all games and stuff. If that happens in the long run, I don't think it serves any purpose. And I don't think it goes anywhere. I think it's more, if it's even done at all, it's done more out of a little bit. A little bit of fear on the other side, because things are not going their way. But in general, I think you do your business straight, you tell the truth, and that kind of stuff is never going to be a problem. So I try not to think about it, and I think Francis will probably not spend much time thinking about it. But
so
certainly
she has had some
problems in the past, and we'll take every precaution to make sure that she's comfortable and can proceed properly.
Okay, you made the trek from Washington, D.C. To Phoenix for this announcement.
Yes.
And you were at the press conference, obviously. Can you characterize it for me?
It was outstanding, in my opinion. This was a first. To my knowledge, if someone else knows of a contending candidate ahead in the polls, or certainly even ahead in the polls of a major party for a high state office or federal office that's had such a press conference, let me know. I'd like to meet them. I'd like to talk to them. There was every possibility for it to be not received properly, but the press were there in force, all the radio stations, the Associated Press, papers.
Huh.
Almost had at least 12, 15 cameras. The supporters were there, both state and from the research field, who came in at their own expense. They were introduced, along with state supporters were introduced. And her state co-campaign manager opened with some very nice remarks. It's a very fine woman. It's going to do a fantastic job. Joan Payne. And then I raised this issue in language that is certainly probably more forceful than I think Mary Frances would say at this time. Because keep in mind, she is in the process of educating herself.
Sure.
She didn't arrive on March 13th full-blown expert in this field. But the point is that things happen in our society, and one of the things we ask our public servants to do is when they do, to educate themselves, to learn, to go to school, so they can make informed judgments, not just take a poll, see what the wind, which way the wind's going, and come out with a soundbite. So she's going to continue to educate herself for the next 9 months, and I believe that by the time perhaps it's ready to take office next year, she will be probably the most knowledgeable politician or public servant in high office statewide in any state in the country. But my statements are fairly strong. They were still okay. They were well received. The questions were reasonable. There were a couple of cute questions, but not many. We had some excellent after-press conference briefings, and the interviews were fine. There was some that even occurred later. ABC re-interviewed her and me, and then they ran a piece tonight. We've had four or five pieces on the 6 o'clock news, all fine. We will certainly be waiting to see the newspapers tomorrow. Now, and the difference here is very significant, and I think I've said this before to your listeners, is that the press is in an awkward position on this and always has been. I am a big supporter of the press. I mean, without them, believe me, our liberties would not be what they are.
That's right.
They are constantly there, constantly vigilant, and if you don't believe that, wait for the next politician to really mess up in a way that they can address it and watch what they do. So they're in an awkward position. If it's a purely UFO issue, they have an editorial barrier there, and it kind of puts them off, and they don't really do what they ought to do. But when something comes in the formal context of our everyday life, they will react. And this is in the formal context. It's what should have happened years ago. Why, after it would take 50 years and tens of thousands of office seekers going after, I'm just referring to just the top two state offices in the House and Senate, which is tens of thousands of office seekers over 50 years. Why has it taken this long for one to say, this is a legitimate campaign issue? I don't know. But it now that it's happened, it is a legitimate issue, and they can appropriately cover it. And guess what? They'll probably do a studious and thoughtful commentary in most regards, and suddenly the issue will be in the standard stream of our public affairs. Gee, what a radical thought.
Yeah.
And Frances is a model here, and 20 more politicians will bring it into their purview later on, then we're getting someplace. So all of all, it was a great success. We're very happy with the coverage. We think the media is going to rise to the occasion, and talk to me in about 30 days.
Yeah, I understand. All right, as a co-campaign manager, one thing that you would have to do, two things, I would think, as part of your job description. One is to determine the viability of Frances's candidacy for this office, and two is to collect polling information. Can you give me answers on either one of those?
Could you hold 1 second? I'll grab a piece that will just 1 second, Art.
Oh, sure. I mean, the job of any campaign manager, as I said, is to pretty much determine the viability of somebody's candidacy and then to track the polls.
Sorry, Art. What was the first half of that question?
Well, in other words, you must have had something to do with assessing the viability of her candidacy for this position.
I understand. I'm in sort of a unique niche here. We have a co-campaign manager who is an accomplished and a person in her own right in terms of positions she's held. She's on the Mesa City Council now. She's served a number of terms. She's very familiar with the state. What you're talking about there is really under her purview.
Okay.
Keeping the pulse on the issues here, making sure that those are certainly covered. And probably some polling will be done, though I don't view Frances as a poll-driven candidate, and I really would not like to see her that way. But those decisions will be made. So I don't think I'll be involved in that part. My focus is to... The problem that any candidate would face is that when they take the issue on, from the moment they make that point, the press descends.
Oh, yeah.
And they have all these questions, and so if you don't arrive at that point, a full-blown expert, what do you do? It's one of the reasons people cannot make that move. My job is to help bring the full resources of the entire research community within this country and even beyond the borders of this country, and make it available to her in various ways so that no question will go unanswered. Anything that arises can be properly addressed, and so that the discussion of the Phoenix Lights, of the government posture, of all of the issues which are generally dear to all of our hearts, not just a few buffs, can be handled intelligently and appropriately so that everybody wins. So I'm going to be more in a national arena. There's a lot of national support for her. We are going to create a website, which will be up in a few days, which is going to have information on the candidacy, which is going to grow. In other words, the site will improve very quickly over the next few weeks. Once again, Anagram Video out of Seattle. Joe Bergeron's people are going to do that for free as support for her. And if I may give that URL out so people can bookmark it or note it, her campaign site, and I think this is part of the future.
Sure.
Politics is going to be waged on the Internet in the future. You can just about count on it. It's a simple one, www.FrancisEmmaBarwood, and that's Francis with an E-S, FrancisEmmaBarwood.com. And we expect a lot of people to check in on her from around the world who have an interest in this issue. We expect very likely that financial support is going to come from people in the field who see the overarching issues which she's bringing to bear very courageously. And that would be wonderful, because Frances is a just a basic person. She and her husband, Mike, are just a basic middle-class family. They're like just about everybody else in the state. They will almost certainly be outspent 10 to 1 in this campaign. And you can anticipate a great deal of money will be spent against them. And the additional support will be very, very helpful. So I'm going to be helping direct that. And also, there are other political developments, as you know, we've discussed, which are going to be happening concurrently with her campaign, which will end in the first stage of which will end in the September primaries.
Right.
And so those are not going to be trivial. Those are going to have an impact on what happens. And so I'm going to try to make sure that she's appraised of those things. So I'm kind of in a sort of a niche position. I am not a knowledgeable person on the hard issues in Arizona. And I'm not going to pretend that I am. I do have a background in consulting and organization and so forth, and I may be able to assist a little bit. But Joan Payne will, I'm sure, do a very fine job.
Well, I know what it means when you say you're going to be outspent 10 to 1 now.
Mm.
Money is a mother's milk of politics. Advertising equals votes.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't get away from that. There have been some wonderful success stories of people beating the odds, but they're few and far between.
But there's a very important point here. The American public is not comfortable with people who are not running on principle, who are spending fortunes to try to get an office for whatever, like it's a trophy to put on the wall.
Yep.
I believe with the use of the Internet, the use of extensive media talk shows like your own, that it's possible for people to get their messages out better, spend a fraction of the money, and still get a reasonable hearing from the electorate. And I believe this is the future. And I think we're going to use the Internet in a big way. And if that serves as a model, then there's another aspect of this candidacy which takes it beyond the borders of Arizona. If I may, and if this is not appropriate, you just tell me, because I don't know all your rules and regulations. But if it's okay, I can give, for those people out there that are appreciative of the kind of courage it takes to step forward on a platform and tell the world, I'm not going to let this issue rest. Even though I'm running for an office, I could give out the address where people who are desirous to possibly support could send donations. Is that okay?
That's okay.
All right. It's very, very simple. Donations, which can be no greater than $760 by Arizona state law, need to be sent to Barwood Election Committee. All right, that's kind of a standard name there, the Barwood Election Committee.
Right.
And it's a P.O. Box. It's 86189. That's P.O. Box 86189. 89, Phoenix, Arizona, of course, and the zip code is 85080, 85080, and then an additional four numbers, 6189, 85080-6189, and by law, any donation to a candidate in Arizona must be accompanied by not only the name, but also the address, the individual's employer, who they work for, and their occupation.
Really?
Yeah, that's the law. And I think it has to do with being able to avoid campaign abuses, funding abuses. Hopefully that's not too prime for some people, but that is necessary. Without those four things, name, address, employer, and occupation, any donations would be returned.
Yeah, is it legitimate, Stephen, for somebody in the state of Illinois or Mississippi or wherever to support an Arizona candidate.
Oh, absolutely. No problem. We're not certain about someone who's not a U.S. citizen. It may be that that is not permissible. We'll check into that because, to be honest with you, I expect support to come in from around the world. You know, the one thing about an internet site is that it is a level playing field.
I know.
If you're in Bangladesh, you've got as much access to it as somebody in Tempe. And so the fact that she has some issues here, which I think touch on the concerns of people completely that she will never meet, but who live on the other side of the world, I think you're going to see support even in that regard. And that's fine. That's perfectly okay. You know, all politics is local. And the fact is that these phenomena, if all these phenomena only occurred over the White House, you know, every few days, that would be one thing. But you know where they're occurring? They're in our backyards. They're over our houses. And so it's a state issue. It's a local issue.
Sure.
Whether we have an Air Force or not. And so in the sense that she represents the state of Arizona, she really is representing the same dilemma that every state in the union faces on this. And so it is perfectly appropriate for people around the country to say, well, look, since nobody else around here is going to step forward, since you're going to do it, I'll support you. Then other people look at you and say, wait a minute. People think that's a good thing. Maybe I'll do that. Next thing you know, we'll have 50 candidates addressing this issue. And that's certainly going to change the landscape. And in that case, I think it's a good thing.
Though you are not an expert on Arizona politics, how would you assess her chances, a pragmatic, honest assessment of her chances?
Well, this is a tumultuous state. One thing is for sure. One, she has the highest name recognition in the state. Two, she has a clearly defined image and a clearly defined reputation. She has a winning track record. She's won her elections for council. She's won the recall election. She's also a national figure, a positive one, and that I think reflects well on Arizona. In a recent poll, though I cannot confirm this, she was running ahead in all rural counties.
Really?
The people that took the poll, I don't think, liked the results, so they didn't publish it. But I cannot confirm this, so this could be an urban myth. But she certainly did fine in the polls. I think even in Maricopa, she was up in the high 40% range. So she is clearly a viable candidate. She has a clear constituency in the Republican Party, and this is a closed primary.
You know they're going to try to stop her.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think, yes, of course they will. But that's their prerogative. They have every right to. Let them bring out the big guns.
Well, they will.
Yeah, and that's all right.
They will.
And as I said at the press conference today, in addition to the five or six individuals who came from out of state at their own expense to show their support for her, people that are in the field that we are familiar with, behind them are hundreds of researchers, many of which who could have come if it had been more convenient and wouldn't have cost so much. And then behind them are tens of thousands of people who are quite knowledgeable on the subject.
All right, Stephen, we're out of time.
Okay.
My friend, as always, I appreciate it. Pass on my best to Frances. She is one courageous lady, believe me.
Thank you, Art. Look forward to keeping you updated on this. And I know you'll like to have Frances back again as we proceed through this.
You can
depend on interesting experience.
You can depend on it. Thank you, Stephen.
All righty.
Good night, and we will be back, I think. Director of the Trends Research Institute is the world leader in trend forecasting. He is publisher of the Trends Journal newsletter, author of the highly acclaimed new book Trends 2000, and Trend Tracking, a Warner book, which Time says is far better than megatrends. Gerald Celente and the Trends Research Institute, Rhinebeck, New York, accurately forecast the 1997 Asian currency crisis, the 87 world stock market crash, the advent of environmental marketing, the emergence of clean foods, gourmet coffees, microbrews, corporate downsizing, and consumer downspending, the demise of the Soviet Union, the length and depth of the recession and other major social, political, business, and consumer trends. The Institute provides businesses with commissioned research studies in over 300 trend categories. For additional information, you can order the Trends Journal newsletter, and we'll tell you how to get that as the program progresses. Flu. I have a high interest in it right now because here I am again, down pretty far down with it and pretty sick. And my wife, who is an asthmatic, came down with it, I think, 2 days ago and has been in an extremely serious asthmatic attack as a result of it. So for her, it's even more serious than it is for me. So now we're both sick as dogs. Gerald, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Art. I'm honored to be on your show.
Where are you, in New York?
I'm up in Rhinebeck, New York, which is about 2 hours north of New York City in the Hudson Valley.
Oh, okay. You heard my sad little description of my current condition and that of my wife and that of many, 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 many others across a substantial portion of the U.S. There's something going on this year that's way beyond anything we have experienced before. I think short of the Black Plague of flu, in 1918 or something. This is getting rather serious, and I'm not sure that it's directly down your alley, but something's going on here, Gerald. Any comments?
Well, yes, and as a matter of fact, this is something that we wrote about in the beginning of the book, Trends 2000. And the way we set the book up is that you wake up, it's the year 2000, and you're looking back to see how you got here. And I'd like to read to you just a quick paragraph from the book.
Sure.
A new and mysterious toxic soup had mounting numbers of people falling prey to a new and hitherto rare illness, some of them strange, debilitating, chronic, and resistant to treatment, even fatal. The new Black Plague forecast in the 80s by the Trends Research Institute was starting to surface in the 90s. And then we show how this is coming about by taking newspaper articles from the major newspapers that had appeared in the 90s. And some of them, infectious diseases on the rebound in the U.S., a report says.
Mm-hmm.
That was from the New York Times in 1994. Researchers warn of, quote, medical disaster as bacteria evolve. And it goes on, common bacteria that cause pneumonia and many other diseases are evolving into forms untreatable by all known medicines, threatening a chilling post-antibiotic era that would be, quote, nothing short of a medical disaster, a researcher said. Quote, in the post-antibiotic world, the simplest infections could quickly escalate into fatal illnesses, said Alexander Tomas of Rockefeller University in New York City. Most people think it will happen, he said. It's unpredictable when, and the consequences, no one knows. The mortality is quite high. That was from 1994, and it goes on and on.
So in other words, you could get something like I've got now. It could convert into a pneumonia, and there would be no antibiotic that would act against it, and you would your lungs would fill, and you would die.
Exactly. And this is a, we call it immune system breakdown. And we have been forecasting that the barrage of toxic chemicals, pollutants, what they've done to our food supply, with the enormous amounts of antibiotic drugs that are shot into the food supply through various different ways, are all taking a toll on our immune systems. I mean, look what's going on in Hong Kong. I mean, this is the global age. All things are connected. So when they're killing over a million chickens,
oh, yes,
because of the fear of this bird flu spreading to people, mad cow disease, they just announced that they're killing a whole nother herd in France. I mean, is it any wonder that people are falling prey to these illnesses? And the wonder drugs can no longer stop the wonder bugs.
Well, where's it all going? I mean, is there going to be, in your opinion, a complete breakdown? Are we really going to go into a post-antibiotic era, one in which antibiotics simply stop working altogether, even the last ditch? And I'll tell you, I've talked to some doctors, And some of what they told me was really frightening. I forget what the number of different antibiotics they had in their arsenal was, but it was in the hundreds, and it's been reduced by hundreds, and they have very few left. I mean, this is from solid medical doctors that I've interviewed. They're saying they're almost ready to run out.
Well, it's happening. Again, here's another one. Drug-proof disease spreading. Misuse of antibiotics is producing drug-resistant bacteria, fueling the resurgence of cholera, tuberculosis, and other diseases, the World Health Organization said. That was in 12-6-94. That was an AP Wire story service.
Mm.
And we go on to say the wonder bugs were winning the battle with the wonder drugs. Environmental AIDS was a fact of life. And that's what we're really calling this. This is an environmental AIDS as we see it. And unfortunately, this is a forecast that we had made in black and white a number of years ago. And in my new book, Trends 2000, what we do is we show how this onslaught of a continuing barrage, again, of environmental disasters, with our water supply, food supply, what's going on in the air with all the pollutants. I mean, we're all becoming susceptible to this.
Here's a curiosity, and I don't expect you to have an answer. I live not far from Death Valley. My neighbors, for the most part, are lizards, snakes, coyotes. I don't come into contact with human beings. I'm no Howard Hughes. I'm not a recluse, but I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. And you've got to bear in mind that I caught whatever this horrid little flu is first. My wife has some contact outside, but I caught it first. So she didn't vector it to me. I caught this first, and there's nobody out here, Gerald, to give it to me. And I really mean that. There's nobody here to give it to me. This is the desert is a rather sterile environment. And I have serious questions about how I could have come down with this, because I have no idea how it could have been vectored to me unless it came sailing through the air. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, here's what we say. Unlike AIDS, which is caused by a virus and transmitted under certain conditions by bodily fluids, the new black plagues were caused by pollution of the environment and transmitted by the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat.
Mm.
That's how you got it.
So there's no escaping it.
There's no escaping it as long as you breathe, drink, and eat.
Boy. What have we learned? What do we know at this moment about the bird flu? Have they contained it? Is it not transmissible between people, or is it still something we're really worried about?
Well, we're worried about it, and I'll tell you why. Because what we see when they do these high-profile publicity stunts, as they did in Hong Kong with killing a million chickens, they do that to give us the impression that by this dramatic action it's going to be eliminated. And, of course, we know that that's just ridiculous. They didn't do anything by killing all those chickens, except probably cause a whole lot of other problems in the disposal of all those carcasses.
Yeah.
So they don't know again, and it's very important to go over the facts about these infectious disease, these drug-proof diseases that are spreading. And look what went on, Art, with the spread of this mad cow disease.
Yes.
You know, first they deny it, and then they ignore it, and then when it comes back, they say, well, you know, it's just an isolated incident, and we need more proof, and then it keeps on spreading and spreading. We've reached a point here, again, when we have done so much damage as a society to our environment, again, what we eat, drink, and breathe, that, you know, it's going to be very difficult to turn this around.
I listen to conservatives, like Rush, like others, who would say to somebody like yourself, man, what a scaremonger, pollution, all the rest of it, give us a break, we can't hurt this planet, and you're doing nothing but scaremongering. How do you respond to those sorts of people?
Well, the way I respond is look at the facts. And the facts are mounting. When people are dying and people are getting sick, and somebody is saying that, you know, that's not an iceberg you hit, I say to them, you know, I'm not going to argue with them, and I don't get involved in ideological warfare in the terms that I consider myself a political atheist. So I don't get involved in that. I just stay with the facts as a researcher. And for some people, Art, there's never going to be enough proof. I mean, look, the tobacco industry is still debating whether or not nicotine is addictive or smoking causes lung cancer.
Right.
And the other thing is that a lot of these people who are ideologues are also on the dole in terms of, that's very, very funny, actually. I said that. I just read today over the wire that Bob Dole is taking a commission from Taiwan now as a lobbyist.
Is he really?
Yeah. after bouncing on Clinton, you know, again, that's why I call myself a political atheist, because to me both sides are hypocritical.
A lot
of these people who call themselves conservative are also taking payoffs in the form of you know, the money that they're getting on a side of a special interest.
Okay, listen, I'm with you. A few years ago, Gerald, I more or less gave up on politics. I literally gave up on it. There was a time in this country, in my lifetime, and I'm 52 years old now. I think I'm 52. And there was a time when generally you would trust what the government would say, what the FBI would say. If there was a news conference, man, it was like gold. They came out and said it, and you believed it. Now, those days are long gone, and there's a lot of cynicism that's gone under the bridge in America, and I have sort of given up on politics, both sides. I looked at them, and I said, look, we're not arguing over matters of substance. The arguments they're having are myopic, very partisan, and of very little value or interest or effect with regard to the life of the average American person. And so I kind of gave up. Sounds like you.
Yeah, I'm 51, you know, so I've gone through the same thing. And I don't get in those arguments. You know, and again, talking about your sickness and what's happening to so many millions of people around the world, you know, we say staying healthy wasn't what it used to be, eating 3 square meals a day, exercising, not smoking, and drinking in moderation no longer sufficed. A multiplicity of factors conspired to break down people's immune systems.
So it's insidiously occurring to everybody.
Exactly. I mean, Art, you know, there has to be a time when we start applying our God-given common sense. I mean, you cannot keep this, just as you can't continue to drink, mistreat your body, smoke, and expect yourself to be healthy, you can't dump billions of tons of pollutants into the air, put hormones and drug additives into our foods, pollute our water, and expect us to be healthy. It's not going to happen.
Well, if any man could be an island, I could be, and almost have been. And it got to me anyway. So if it can get to me out here in the middle of the desert, it can get to anybody. And it is happening. So if you forecast this as a trend, that's going to be what I call a ding, 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 ding. You hit that one right on the head, because that's not what's coming. That's what's here right now. Gerald, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and broaden this discussion. I'm Art Bell, with a rather high temperature, but nevertheless here. This ask you generally, what kind of a year, based on current trends, is 1998 going to be?
All right. I've been at this for almost 20 years. We've been publishing for about 12. And I can tell you that 1998 is probably one of the worst years we've looked at. It is, actually. And we're not gloom and doomers. And, you know, we're not alarmists. But the data is coming in, and it's showing us that this is going to be a very difficult year financially, economically for the nation. We're going to see more downsizing for the working people and a lot of political unrest around the globe.
Mm.
So having said that, there's probably be some bright spots, of course, as well. But we're in for some real tough sledding for the next couple of years.
Well, one of the things we're doing, Gerald, is we are continuing to use the combustion engine in automobiles, and we are continuing to put immense amounts of things into the air from all of these automobiles. Anybody who doubts that should just take a ride outside any major U.S. city and look back at the city, and the pall of awfulness hanging over that city is readily apparent. Trend-wise, into this next millennium, where are we going? Are we all about to be getting rid of these gas-burning, guzzling vehicles, and will we have some amazing electric car? What's coming?
Well, we believe that we're on the verge of a major breakthrough of free energy, virtually operationally cost-free, pollution-free, and portable. We believe it's going to come probably through either cold fusion or zero-point energy. Now, of course, cold fusion is developing a nuclear reaction, a radiation-free nuclear reaction, at temperatures far below the millions of degrees of hot fusion.
Is it real?
Well, scientists say it's not. And I remind you, Art, that just about 100 years ago, as Marconi was transmitting with his wireless across the English Channel, the scientists of the day were calling him a fraud, and the Italian government wouldn't give him any money to back his invention. He had to go to England. As the Wright brothers were flying out of Kitty Hawk's Scientific American magazine was saying it was a hoax. And the zero-point energy, of course, is that physicists acknowledge that there's electricity in the air.
All right, well, what's going on in this country? I mean, Pons and Fleischmann also had to go to Great Britain. I believe that's where they went.
And well, what's going on is that there's one very promising device out right now, and it's called the Patterson Power Cell.
Right.
And what he's doing is he's neutralizing radioactive material in a matter of hours that would normally take billions of years to happen on its own.
I saw that demonstration on ABC's Good Morning America. It was incredible.
Exactly. And do you know that the people from Infinite Energy magazine had alerted the scientific press of the science journalists of the major press to tell them that that was going to be on, and nobody picked up on it. Just think, Art, what this will mean to the oil industry.
Well, I am thinking about that, and my next question is, will we have this amazing discovery prior to or following our running out of fossil fuels? My understanding is at present rates of usage, we've got about 40 or 45 years of fossil fuels left. After that, we better have Patterson fuel cells.
Because we believe we're going to see in the next couple of years. We may even hear of announcements of hot water heaters within the next 2 years. So this is on the doorstep, and nobody's going to stop it. You know, just as Edison didn't need General Electric or Bell didn't need AT&T, all of these scientists working out there, they don't need the major oil companies.
Well, I was about to ask. I mean, are we going to see the Exxon fuel cell for your house or Port-a-Pack or in other words, are the oil companies going to be the ones to do this, or is it going to be despite them?
It's going to be despite them. It's not in their best interest to have this happen. And by the way,
either way, Gerald.
Exactly.
So it's not going to happen easily.
Well, you can't stop it. It's an evolutionary process in terms that, I mean, here we are going into the 21st century and we're still burning coal. I mean, you know, it's going to happen with or without them.
I you're sure you're not underestimating the political power and even more of the oil companies? I mean, where there is that much money, there's a lot of power.
They've been trying to hold it up for a lot of years. The scientists have been belittling and deriding the scientists that have been working with this process. And, you know, who can say how much longer it will be held up? But there are forces also that are also powerful that find it in their interest to have this happen. As a matter of fact, it's being reported that the largest hot water heater company in the United States, for instance, is backing one of these processes. And there are companies like Motorola involved in it and others.
Uh-huh. Well, I would say if that is the case, there is a chance. So that's a little bit of good news.
Yes.
Where else do you see good news in present trends?
Well, we're going to see a lot of focus going toward health, fitness, and nutrition, obviously. And that's very positive. We're going to see, for instance, malls start to redefine themselves in terms that we saw that this past Christmas season, regardless of the hype from the retailers, people aren't shopping. They're not buying stuff like they used to.
It's true. And you know, people had money to spend, but they didn't spend it. What happened?
Well, we're an aging population. The median age in 1970 was 28 years old. It's approaching 36, and very soon it's going to be 40.
Wow.
We have all the stuff that we need. So you're going to see these malls, rather than being anchored by department stores, you might see a mega health club on one end, a type of bread and circus or Whole Foods Health Mart on the other. So people going there are going to go to socialize as well as to work out, maybe get a massage, go to a store where they shop for their health, and also financial health. They're going to become more community-oriented for an aging population of baby boomers. By the way, there are as many single households in the United States as there are married couples with children. So these malls are going to begin to develop to take care of a population that's no longer going to singles bars, and they're never going to go to bingo halls.
So the new social centers are going to be the malls.
Just as the surrogate, unfortunately, you know, of course, the downtown communities are also going to be in the areas where the downtowns haven't been destroyed and they're building up. But for most of the country, we have to understand that the suburban sprawl has created these malls as kind of surrogate downtowns. So they're going to be redesigned to meet the needs of this population, yes.
All right. The current meltdown in Asia, very, very serious. There's much argument about how it's going to affect U.S. Markets over the next year or so. And I wonder how you look at it, where is it going, how much effect is there going to be?
We had forecast the Asian meltdown in my book, Trends 2000, when it came out in hardcover a year ago. On page 47, it says, all over the world, house of cards economies built on a foundation of high interest rates and overspeculation are collapsing. As the economies went down, so did their currencies. So we saw this happen. This is the 1920s all over again. This crisis has happened because of the high speculation made possible, by the availability art of cheap and easy money. So now what's going to happen? You know, first everyone was applauding the great Asian miracle. And now that the crash has happened over there, they're saying, well, you know, it really doesn't affect us. And we're immune to this contagion. Well, the contagion can no longer be quarantined. We expect the next shoe to fall is going to be Japan. But the Japanese are going to put on a straight face, and they're going to say that things aren't that bad, even though now they're reporting that their loans in default are about twice as bad as they just reported a couple of weeks ago. So they're going to keep up the facade on the outside that this thing is being held together, In the meantime, the core of their economy is being eaten away. We are going to, we are on the verge of a global meltdown, a global currency meltdown. And we're very concerned about the future. As a matter of fact, what we are advising people is just as though you have car insurance or homeowner's insurance, we suggest you get some money insurance. And that means buying gold, any way that you buy it, whether it's shares, bullion, coins, whatever you like best.
No,
but only in terms of not, you know, head for the hills, get into the bunker mentality, but as an insurance policy.
A hedge.
A hedge.
Yeah. And the price of gold is at historic lows. It might have gone up a few dollars yesterday or something, a couple bucks, but it basically it's lower than we've seen it in a long, long time.
Well, look what's happened. On October 27th, Art, the day the market lost 554 points, coincidentally, the Bank of Switzerland announced that they were thinking of unloading half their gold reserves.
Right.
I mean, that's a little coincidental, isn't it? Then we hear, of course, Australia, Belgium, Netherlands, Argentina, Canada, all big sellers of their gold reserves. So they're knocking down the price artificially. The one thing the financial community does not want to happen is to have people go to precious metals and abandon these worthless currencies. Look what's happened to these stable currencies across the globe. They've lost over more than half their value in most cases within a matter of weeks. You know, we, again, you know, we have a publication, the Trends Journal. We had sent it out at the end of September of this year, the front page story, warning, currency crisis.
We saw this coming. It is interesting. The South Korean government asked the people of South Korea to donate their gold, and they did. They started bringing in all their gold. The damnedest thing I ever saw, piles of rings and gold and so forth and so on, trying to get themselves out of this disaster. And I've never quite seen anything like it. I guess it has occurred before.
Well, yes, and it's occurring all over the Asian markets. You know, another interesting thing that's going on, too, that we should understand, strong anti-American sentiments building as well. You know, when they talk about IMF austerity measures, you know what that means? It means higher taxes, higher interest rates,
right,
higher unemployment, higher prices, lower wages.
The IMF dictates to these countries, and they either follow the IMF's plan or they have their legs cut out from under them. They don't get any loans. They don't get any bailouts. They don't get any help. And so they either follow the IMF rules or else. Now, that smacks of not a one-world government, but certainly a one-world economy moving toward a political change that would mean a one-world government. Is that too much of a reach?
No, it's not, because look what's going on with this. When we say that, look at the problems that are going to develop, there's going to be strong anti-Westernism or anti-Americanism developing in these countries, because also one of the conditions of the so-called IMF bailout is that they open their economy, their financial institutions to takeovers of American corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're financing the American financiers to go into these countries and take over their financial institutions. Well, if you're a national of those countries, you don't really like that. And that's why in South Korea, they are also burning American and Western products in effigy.
Are they going to try to trade their way out of this? That's another one that everybody's asking about. In other words, produce an imbalance in trade, pumping cheap Asian goods into the U.S. and European markets to try to get themselves out of hock.
Oh, absolutely. I'll get back to that in just one second, because it also something strange just occurred to me. Isn't it interesting that we sent over our Secretary of Defense?
Yes.
to Asia,
yes,
to talk to these governments about taking on these austerity measures?
Well, it's a national defense issue in a way.
Yeah, I guess so. So, yes, they are going to also try to export their way out of this. It's going to cause a deflationary cycle to take hold. And it's also going to mean more lost jobs for the American worker. And it's already happening. We're in downsizing, too. Look what's happened just in the last couple of weeks. Owen Corning announcing that they're laying off 9% of their workforce. Kodak, Polaroid, Kimberly-Clark, Hasbro, Polaroid, who else?
And all of these earnings warnings as well.
Exactly. Boeing, there's another one. They're going to be laying off an estimated 12,500 workers by June.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's a lot. And then when they start importing these cheap products into our country, more jobs are going to be lost. Wages will continue to go down. We are in some very, very treacherous times, contrary to what President Clinton says, quote, this is not a glitch in the road.
Now, I don't know that I agree with Chris, but it's obvious. It says, hey, Art, see, I was sitting here musing about how could I have the flu? I don't have contact with anybody. I'm not a recluse, but on the other hand, I don't go out. I do the show from home. I've got a studio here in my home. I don't go anywhere. I'm very careful about who comes here. How the hell could I have gotten the flu? And so Chris writes, hey, Art, wondering how you got the flu, high atop your throne out there isolated in the kingdom of Nye. I don't have a throne. Ever hear of a biological mail bomb? You don't have visitors, but I bet you get mail. Scary thought, huh? I think I read in a science fiction book where there was a character that was assassinated through such a fictitious means, Chris in Beaverton. Well, you know what? I'm not prepared to jump to that sort of conclusion, but the light bulb, even in my temperature-fogged brain, went off. Of course I get mail, and I stubbornly read all my mail. Why didn't I think of that? People licking envelopes, opening envelopes, touching your eye, touching your mouth. Of course, I should have thought of it. Good thinking, Chris. Thank you. And so that probably accounts for how I contracted it, or at least it's one very, very good answer. Now, Gerald Celente is my guest, director of the Trends Research Institute, a world leader in trend forecasting. Publisher of the Trends Journal newsletter. We will certainly tell you how to get that. They have forecasted accurately the 97 Asian currency crisis, the 87 world stock market crash, advent of environmental marketing, emergency of clean foods, gourmet coffees, and microbrews, corporate downsizing and consumer downspending, the demise of the Soviet Union, length and depth of the recession, and other major social, political, and business and consumer trends. They look at over 300 trend categories, as a matter of fact. Here, once again, from New York, up late, is Gerald Celente. Gerald, we're going to move into some rather interesting territory right now. You have looked at the coming millennium madness, have you not? What people are calling millennium madness, the crop of doom mongers, Armageddonites, soothsayers, psychics, channelers, numerologists, cultists, so forth and so on. What kind of year is it going to be for those folks?
Well, a big year for the cult people. A lot of them are pointing to 1998 as the year of the beginning of the end.
End of the world,
yep. Some of them, for instance, one just moved from Taiwan to Dallas, Texas. They're saying that we're going to see the second coming in March, and by 1999, we're going to see the end of the world. And, of course, the American psychic Edgar Cayce, before he died, had predicted that in 1998 they were going to dig beneath the paws of the Great Sphinx of Giza, uncover a secret chamber, the history of the lost city of Atlantis would be revealed, and that, too, would be a signal of the second coming.
Oh, what a perfect setup you have given me. My guest tomorrow night is the director of antiquities at Giza in Egypt, Dr. Zahi Hawass. And I guarantee you mention Atlantis to Zahi Hawass, Dr. Hawass, and he will go through the roof. Absolutely through the roof. He will say, never in the history of all the research and archaeological diggings at Giza has anybody uncovered even one speck of evidence of anything like Atlantis or a Hall of Records or any of the rest of it. He's adamant on the subject. Do you have anything you can think of that I should ask him tomorrow night?
Well, as I understand it, there were some studies done, some scientific studies, that reveal the possibility of a chamber beneath the paws of the Sphinx.
That's right.
So that's all I know. And as of course, what we're doing is we're saying this is what people are saying. We're not saying this is what we're saying. And in terms of these gloom and doomers, it's very important to know that you're going to see a lot more of the Heaven's Gate type of cults popping up all over the world. And as a matter of fact, for some strange reason, Geneva, Switzerland appears to be the cult capital of the world with tens of thousands of followers.
There seems to be a trend that I think I've identified. I was involved rather intimately with the Heaven's Gate business. And there seems to be a trend that I've noticed with regard to these cults, and that is that they assemble and maintain themselves based on some sort of prophecy of a specific date when everything is going to go to hell in a handbasket, and they plan their exits accordingly. Now, when the events forecast don't occur, they seem to make it some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy that they do occur, even at a micro level, macro level, and they commit suicide. So they bring on their own forecast, whether it occurs or not. Look at David Koresh and what occurred down there. He was forecasting the end of the world by fire, and the FBI hung in there a long time, no matter how you feel about who started it. Sure enough, the Koresh world ended in fire. So his personal prophecy was correct.
One of the reasons why we're going to see a lot more of this is that there seems to be a millennium fever that happens. As we look back to AD 1000, the prophets of the day in medieval Christendom had the people so afraid that they were abandoning their homes and leaving their crops, seeking refuge in churches and going on holy pilgrimages.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, there's this also what's going on now is there appears to be a breakdown in society in that never before have so many people lost faith in so many institutions simultaneously. So when these cults start developing and people are searching for a direction, they find a lot of willing followers.
There it is. People who have literally given up on everything else are ready to embrace something new.
Exactly.
I've never been a joiner, but I can understand the psychology of a lot of people who are. I guess it's... So we're going to see a lot of this in 98. Now, suppose 98 comes and goes, and we don't go. In other words, we're still here when 1999 rings in. Then what?
Well, then we'll look for some other prophecies. The next one comes about, the big one on 5/5/2000,
yes.
And that is going to be, at that time, some people claim that there's going to be a rare astronomical conjunction of the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn with the Earth and the Moon. And they're saying that this event will have a profound gravitational effect, which will upset the Earth's axis, causing the Antarctic ice cap to shift, and a deluge of ice and water will sweep across the globe. And if that one doesn't work, then a lot of people are looking toward the Mayan calendar, which ends on December 23rd, 2012. And these people believe that the end of the calendar signals an end of the world. And we could keep going on.
Well, we could. As a trend watcher, you've named these. Is it possible that one of these days the doomsayers are going to be right?
I believe that it's very possible. And matter of fact, you know, we're hearing from even the mainstream scientists saying, you know, that for instance, they just came out last week with if an asteroid had struck in the Atlantic, the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, the massive damage it would do. And, you know, we know that, you know, there's a huge system out there, galaxy, and who can tell what would happen if a meteorite or an asteroid.
I saw that story, Gerald, about an asteroid strike into the Atlantic and what would be inundated, and most of the East Coast would go underwater, blah, blah, blah. So, really awful. And now, let me ask you about this. There's movies, disaster movies, asteroids, earthquakes, volcanoes, you know, shake and bake, seriously shake and bake all over the place. Is the media driving this? Or are the people driving the media to produce this kind of stuff? Which is it? Is it a conditioning that's underway? What do you see?
No, but I think that there are a lot of people that feel that the worst can happen. So let's give a realistic scenario that doesn't take in asteroids, meteorites, or UFOs. And we can look at an earthquake, for instance. I mean, they happen quite commonly every day.
Sure.
So why not a couple of earthquakes around nuclear plants?
Great.
One of the stories that's not making the news that should be headline news, other than, of course, you know, a Clinton dog story, is that the Chernobyl plant is collapsing on itself.
It is, yes.
And that story came over the wire that never made the headline news. And what do they say? They say when it collapses, it's going to send out huge amounts of radioactive dust. This isn't dust. Dust is the stuff, you know, that's under the couch, you know, under the bed. This is poison. So let's take earthquakes, disasters like this. Art, the reality is we're sitting on a nuclear time bomb. So I mean, we are faced with a lot of real dangers. And is that, you know, could the people that say that we're alarmists discount the realities of earthquakes, of nuclear power plants and facilities built on earthquake faults?
Well, our scientists would say with the double containment structures we have a great deal of protection, that there has never been in this country the kind of thing that occurred at Chernobyl. We had Three Mile Island, but that was nothing like Chernobyl. And that our double containment will keep us safe. I take it you don't buy that.
Well, you know, they changed the language after the earthquake in Japan a few years ago. It now became from earthquake proof, it became earthquake resistant.
Resistant, yes.
Right. So now let's go for another one. When I wrote the book Trends 2000, we showed how nuclear disasters were possible to happen, also through nuclear terrorism.
Oh, yes, the missing 100 suitcase nukes.
Exactly. But let's look even beyond those 100 suitcase nukes. And let's look at the deplorable rotting conditions of all of the nuclear facilities throughout the former Soviet Union. So when we wrote Trends 2000, we showed how all of these are rotting. Since that time, Art, we saw Russia's chief nuclear physicist commit suicide as a statement to the world of the dangers that exist because nobody would listen to him.
When did that occur?
That occurred about a year and a half ago. Then, two or three weeks after that, we saw the suicide of the head of Russia's National Academy of Science.
Okay. So
and, of course, this isn't making the news. So is the destruction of the planet possible either through outside or man-made circumstances? I would say yes.
What I watched very carefully the Gulf War. The Gulf War was really, really interesting. The difference in the Gulf War seemed to be technology. And the U.S. had night vision. Something I'm advertising here. They had night vision, and they could see the enemy, and the enemy could not see us. And we blew them away in incredible numbers that way, along with the new guided cruise missiles and all the rest of it. What is the nature of warfare, assuming that we remain alive to continue to be the warring type of people that we are? How will the nature of warfare change?
Well, the Gulf War showed that there's no nation on Earth that could challenge the United States face to face. So what we're going to see is more weapons of mass destruction, the suitcase-sized weapons that a former general of the Soviet Army, Alexander Lebed, said that they're missing 100 of.
Yes.
So what we're going to see in this new millennium warfare is biological, chemical warfare, nuclear warfare, or weapons of mass destruction that can be easily transported to any city around the world. And there's no stopping it, regardless of all this huffing and puffing, you know, by these people saying, you know, we're going to crack down on terrorism and we're going to send the message that you could run, but you can't hide. Of course they can hide, because they're, well, let's face it, thousands of tons of drugs are being smuggled into the country each year and spread throughout the nation. Immigrants are flooding over the borders. You mean to tell me you're going to stop a handful of determined new millennium warriors with their weapons of mass destruction? You know, that's real science fiction if you think you're going to do that one. So they're going to continue to try to pass these, or will pass these, so-called anti-terrorism acts as a way of taking away more of our Fourth and First Amendment rights in the, with the belief, the false belief that they're going to be protecting us. But they're not going to be able to. The only thing that's going to be able to protect the American people is a different foreign policy initiative, which means that you can no longer take sides in somebody else's overseas problem.
I take it you don't like our presence in Bosnia.
Well, what we're saying is that if you're going to have a presence or take or go into a situation, it has to be even-handed, not one-sided. Because any time you take a side of one, you've alienated the side of another. So why do bombs explode in the French subways? Well, because France is giving billions of dollars to the military government in Algeria.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, so any time you get in these kind of situations, Art, you're asking for problems.
What would happen societally with our society? Let's say that in some major city, we won't even pick one here. Ah, sure, let's pick one. Las Vegas. Let's say a nuclear device goes off in Las Vegas and blows the capitalist mecca, Sin City, into smithereens. They do that in most movies. What would the reaction of the American people likely be to that?
Well, the first reaction would be, again, you know, let's crack down on those terrorists. But let's take the scenario one step further. Suppose they send out 5 or 7 nuclear terrorists or weapons of mass destruction, and they have one in San Francisco, one in Los Angeles, one in Chicago, one in Atlanta, one in New York, and one in Boston.
We're heard in every single one of those cities. So let's say they all went off. What would happen to American society? Would our
total panic? Let's look at the reality.
Would our republics withstand it?
Probably not.
All right.
Probably not. It would be we would be unable to cope with such a disaster.
All right, Gerald. Hold on. Bottom of the hour. Gerald Celente in New York, where it probably is getting pretty late, huh?
Well, I think it gets this late this time every night.
All right, let's meander through some phone calls and see what people have to say. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Hi, hi, Gerald.
Where are you, sir?
This is Frenchie. I'm in Massachusetts.
Okay.
I hope you. I love you so, and I hope you get over the flu, you and your wife.
Thank you.
Yep. Gerald, one other thing. If you get a chance tonight, could you play that cat thing a couple of times? I'm taping tonight's show.
I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Gerald, good evening. I haven't heard too much in the news lately about these gigantic, unfortunate oil spills around the globe. And I was wondering if some of the new trends for the year 2000 are to somehow they've been able to keep these things from happening. It would be kind of a good trend.
Yeah, it's a very good point, actually. We had many, many oil spills, beginning with the Exxon Valdez, and then a series of disasters, and then nothing. You know what? Huh. Well, somehow we lost Gerald. I have no idea how that occurs. It is a very interesting occurrence because with our phone system, as I think I've explained frequently to you before, we have a special deal that locks in a line. It absolutely locks in a line. Now, I know things can occur and do occur. Well, then let us just move on. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Ron in Kinnick, Alaska.
Kinnick, Alaska, yes, sir.
Yes, sir, and I've been away from the phone for about 40 minutes. I had to go over to the neighbor's house and borrow a phone, and I got the number from a good listener and a friend of ours.
Okay, well, you're on the air now, so go ahead and ask what you would like.
Okay, well, I got something that I've been trying to get in here to let you guys know that something that everybody seemed to overlook. You know, here a while back when we were in Iraq, and we know that Saddam Hussein had one of the most sophisticated biological warfare laboratories in the world, and
that's
we're
right.
Currently still trying to bust this down. A lot of people figured that Saddam Hussein had lit them oil fields to hide himself underneath the smoke screen from our aircraft because we were claiming our air superiority. But I have a whole different perspective on that. My perspective is that Saddam Hussein has released a lot of his chemical and biological weapons by using the thermal draft and the smoke from the heat of the... And, you know, that there would spread that all amongst the world there. And
It is possible. Gerald, what do we don't know a whole lot, do we? They play a shell game over there. The UN tries to inspect to find out what Saddam has. We don't find anything. We play a game with them. We seem to be taunting the Iraqis, spoiling for another fight. How do you add all this up? Are we about to go back at it with Saddam?
We don't think so, but you know, something interesting too is that with this whole Iraqi situation in terms of, you know, the UN reports on what's happening to the people in Iraq, you know, this is kind of reminiscent to what happened to Germany after World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, you know, just about ruined the country, and it set the conditions for a maniac dictator. And we're concerned that this continuing going back and forth with Iraq and starving the country out may make a bad situation worse and make and lay the groundwork for an even more volatile situation. So we're concerned about it.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Hi there. My name is Margaret.
Margaret, I can barely hear you. Where are you?
I'm calling from Seattle, Washington.
Okay, you're going to have to yell at us, dear.
Okay, can you hear this?
No, barely.
Oh, dear. I've been hearing, I read two articles in the newspaper, one yesterday, one the day before. They're both quite long, half-page articles. Two long stories on NPR radio yesterday and today. And I'd like to hear if this has come up on your radar at all. It has to do with the severe shortage of computer professionals, information technology workers. Have you been hearing about that?
Yes.
Okay, well, I have been reading in industry press for quite a number of years now that the big business companies want to import foreign workers into the United States. They're much cheaper than American workers, and they've been doing it overseas, but it just doesn't work as well. They need to bring them into the country. My concern is that the only area left in the American economy where average workers can earn a decent wage is in the information technology field. And my concern is that right now the ducks are being set up to destroy the computer field just as skilled manufacturing has been destroyed.
All right.
I'd like to hear if that's come up at all in, because right now what they want to do is they want to, I know that there's bills before Congress to open up the immigration.
Oh, yes. All right, let's see what Gerald has to say about that. Gerald?
Well, yes, actually, we wrote about this in my book, Trends 2000, how the major companies are bringing in foreign workers with special visas. I believe they call them H-1B visas. And what they're doing is they're paying computer programmers, for instance, from India or Eastern Europe, $20,000 a year for a job that would pay $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year here. And it's also important to understand that the biggest supporters of lax immigration bills is the National Association of Manufacturers. They want to bring in all the cheap help that they can get. So the caller is right on target. They're blowing up this thing that there's this terrible shortage of computer workers, and we have to bring them in from other countries. And it is pretty much a charade.
I'm hearing a lot about the year 2000 bug. What can you tell me about that? Is there going to be a big problem in 2000?
Yes, as far as we know. And as a matter of fact, I just taped the Oprah Winfrey Show yesterday, and it's going to be on the 21st, and one of the fellows on there was talking about the computer bug. And what he is saying is that there are so many bits of information to deal with, billions, that it's highly unlikely that this problem is going to be solved. And as we know, a number of airlines have chosen not to fly on New Year's Eve, 1999.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And this is a fact. I mean, this isn't hearsay. Also, Art, we are going to be in better shape than what's going to happen in the rest of the world because we are so much more advanced computer-wise than so many other nations, particularly in Europe. So we're expecting some real problems. And among the very computer literate, a lot of people are planning to get a lot of proof as to who they are, where their money is, what taxes they have paid, on and on and on. And some people are even talking about taking their money out of banks and stocks and putting it in cash so they're holding it.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, and matter of fact, that's coming from more of the computer people who know the severity of the problem.
That's amazing. I take it this relates mainly to mainframes, not personal computers, or does it relate to personal computers as well?
I believe it relates mainly to mainframes.
Okay, because I'm going to sit here and put January 1st, 2000 into my computer and see what happens, just for grins. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Greetings from cyberspace.
Where in cyberspace? Where are you?
Floating around the East Coast.
All right.
Floating around the East Coast.
Okay.
Just quickly, on year 2000 problem, clearly it is mainly mainframes, but those underlie many of their legacy systems that underlie much of the other layers of technology that are in most of the different governmental agencies and large corporations. So it is a very, very serious problem, if we make it that far. Getting back to the most important topic that Mr. Celente brings out, also a quick comment, terrific website, Mr. Celente.
Thank you.
I think people should visit that, and I hope you'll get that name out a bunch of times. As far as the mass weapons, it's interesting to think about, say, seven different cities. But I've been giving a great deal of thought, and I don't think I'm saying anything here that hasn't been thought of already, so I think we can say it. If there was to be one attack, unfortunately, in a major location, say Wall Street or Washington, D.C., the widespread panic Who would stay in any city, in other words?
Yeah.
If given the choice at that point, you're looking at serious refugee crises all over the place, massive infrastructure collapse, you know, who's manning, you know, who's staying there in effect, and, you know, pretty much picturing the emptying out of all the major cities. And, you know, that's not an inconceivable question. Forget about even the nuclear attack, as you mentioned before. Just a very small biological attack or, you know, concentrated in one city would pretty much do us in, it appears, at this point. I'm wondering what the, you know, in effect, the emergency underlying situation is, because I don't see the preparation. It seems as though the cities are extremely unprepared, having heard from someone pretty high up in a mayor's office. It sounds as though the military pretty much came around and said, you know, here's some pamphlets. And it's very troubling. I'd like you to go deeply into that, if you could, as far as what you think we can do to individually help affect the situation.
Well, you know, as you may know, a number of cities have been very high profile in what they're doing in terms of getting ready for disaster. The reality is they can't do anything. I mean, look what's going on in the East Coast and in Canada with this ice storm.
Exactly.
I mean, this whole place is paralyzed.
That's over a small ice storm.
Exactly.
I mean, we're talking about one small bit of El Nino completely bringing to an end. We're talking about months, they're saying in some cases, for electricity to be returned. And that's some ice. I mean, I think we're talking about, you know, Art has been talking for quite some time about the quickening. And I think it's clear at this point. The question is, you know, what can we as individuals do to help bring about some sort of change? Perhaps it's just a matter of reckoning with their own lives and, you know, gaining some kind of acceptance that, you know, when things do hit the fan, that things are going to be okay, you know, sort of on the other side, if that's how you deal with it. But it's very troubling. And, you know, I'd like to maybe, Mr. Salente, you know, perhaps you could, you know, basically start a groundswell of support and get some, you know, serious discussion on this issue politically. And perhaps with Ms. Barwood's campaign, she could focus on this as well, because this, you know, the alien issue is extremely important, obviously. Perhaps they will provide some of the technology to help us get a hold of some of these existing problems if we haven't pissed them off a little bit too much so far. I'd like to see their help, actually, if they're listening out there. We're not all a bunch of idiots. We would like some help in a friendly way to help gain control of the nuclear problem, you know, the military problem. And, you know, I'd like to hear a lot of people comment about that.
All right.
Well, you know, just on another on the same note, but in a different way, vein, you know, we heard our Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, announce that all of our troops are being inoculated against anthrax.
That's right.
Why?
I don't know. Most of all, I don't know why you would announce it. If you feared an anthrax attack, a military anthrax attack, you might inoculate the troops if you had the ability to do that and you thought there was going to be a conflict. But why would you announce it?
But why even do it?
Well, I don't know.
What I'm suggesting is, are they doing it as a precaution? And if so, as a precaution to what?
I don't know.
So to me, that was a very significant measure. And also, it was a very significant measure in that all of a sudden, the term weapons of mass destruction is now making the headlines. So, I think there's a lot to be concerned about. And, as far as what we can do, you see, I actually believe that this whole movement of so-called spirituality is really the search among people in trying to understand what our divine purpose is and trying to reach a higher consciousness, with the understanding that we are not accidental glitches in an uncaring universe and that we all have a purpose, individually and collectively. And with people trying to change their inner worlds for the better, the outer world will change for the better as well. And that's what I really believe. So it's what each of us do in order to improve ourselves, and then bringing that to the outside is what's going to bring the change.
Well, what do you make of this move toward a more spiritual nature in people?
Well, again, it is this phenomenon. And again, we're not kids, you know. You know, you've been around 52, I've been around 51 years. And that is that never before have so many people lost faith in so many of the institutions. And we're saying to ourselves, you know, what am I doing here? What's my purpose? why am I here? And people are trying to find that out, and they're searching within themselves for the answer. So this, to us, is a very positive movement. And I'm not talking about, you know, this new age narcissism.
Ryan, I understand. You're talking about something far more serious.
Yes.
Okay, hold tight, Gerald, and we'll get back to you in a moment. Actually, you've got several moments, and we'll do one more hour, and we'll try and concentrate heavily on the phones. We will also tell, go get a piece of paper and a pencil, because we are going to tell you how to get the Trends Journal, which is Gerald's newsletter. He's also got a book, and we'll tell you how to get that. So if you've got a paper and a pencil prepared for after the news break, you'll be able to get that information. In the meantime, I have not had my studio cam on tonight, but I thought I'd just give it a try. So I just loaded my computer with January 1st, 2000. And if you go look at my studio cam now on the website, you will see that I got the photograph up there a minute and 25 seconds into the year 2000. And what it came up with, I'll let you go see for yourself. But my personal computer, I guess, is going to handle it okay. I did that a little hesitantly. I wasn't exactly sure what was going to happen, but I just went into the Windows 95 operating system. I'm going to make you wander off into a strange area for a moment here. I'm not sure if it's connected with the Millennium. It may be. But there are many, many, many serious people out there who believe now that we are being visited from people, by people from elsewhere, other dimensions, other worlds, whatever. All of the interest in this sort of thing is growing by leaps and bounds. Is it another trend?
Well, yes, it is. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it's in the 60 percentile of people believe that there is either life, intelligent life, or that the government is hiding information from us. And most of those people are college educated. Here's my story. About 1983, my ex-wife and I were driving across the Rhine Cliff Kingston Bridge, a bridge that spans the Hudson River.
Of course.
And it was about at 10 o'clock at night, and as we were going over the bridge, and at this time, by the way, I was doing a lot of hot air ballooning. So I had and flying a lot in one-engine plane, too. And I had a good sense of speed and height in the air. And about 500 feet above us, as we reached the apex of the bridge, I saw this red triangle coming out of the northeast.
Here we go.
And moving at about 30 knots an hour.
Really?
And I stopped the car on the top of the bridge. And, of course, you know, this is a pretty rural area, not a lot of traffic. And I jumped out of the car, and I watched this thing slowly going across the Hudson River.
My God, it sounds just like what I saw.
And at the same time, the bridge authority saw me stopped up there, and a guy came up in a truck and started screaming at me, you know, get back in your car. And I said, look at that. And he said, don't be stupid. Those are helicopters flying in formation. Get back in your car. I turned around, and as I took one step, I stopped, and I yelled out back to him, you're not making any noise. It was totally silent. Well, the next day, when we got off the other end of the bridge, there were about 15 cars stopped also watching it. And the next day in the news, you know, virtually thousands of people saw it.
Yep.
And, of course, the report was that it was a training flight of some kind, you know.
Uh-huh.
But you know, I'm not stupid. I had been doing a lot of hot air balloon flying, and you know, I had a good sense of height and speed, and I know what I saw.
All right, Gerald. I vowed not to do this, but I can't resist. I want to tell you my story. Okay. As I have been stressing throughout the night, I live out here in the middle of nowhere, desert. I was on the way. I used to commute between Las Vegas and where I live here. It's about 130 miles round trip a day. I did that for years. About 4 years ago, my wife and I were on the way home, and I would say, Gerald, that we were about, oh, I don't know, half mile from home here. And so we were in the middle of virtually nowhere. My wife was in the passenger seat. I was driving. She caught in peripheral vision something coming from behind or saw it in the mirror. I really don't know. She said, what the hell is that? And it was coming up from behind us. And I said, I don't know. And I pulled the car over and I shut off the engine. And Gerald, out here, I could go outside right now and listen and hear absolutely nothing. You know, I might hear a cricket in the summer at about a quarter mile, and that's what I could hear, was a cricket at about a quarter mile away, and that was the only sound. Here coming up from behind us was this incredibly large, I would estimate from about 150 feet from one point of the triangle to the other, a black triangle, nearly a full moon clear night. It could not have been more than 150 feet in the air. I have described it as doing about 30 miles an hour. I was in the Air Force, Gerald. I know what aerodynamic flight is, and I know what it isn't. This was not flying. It was floating. It proceeded to float directly over our heads and continue out toward the west-northwest. And we watched it go across the entire valley that I live in here. We had a view looking down on the valley. And we watched it, oh, I don't know, for 5 or 6 minutes until we finally lost track of it as it floated across the valley. Now, this craft was massive. There was enough light with the moon that I could make out the actual substance of the craft. It wasn't just lights. There was substance. It was real as a heart attack, Gerald. And that changed my life forever. My wife and I talked about it. She doesn't much like the whole subject, but I dragged her on the air and made her verify my story. I was scared to go on the air and say it myself. So that's what I saw, Gerald. And it was close, and it was real, and it's one of two things. Either our military has advanced technology that, you know, is not even hinted at, which is possible, or it was something from elsewhere. And it sounds a lot like what you saw. And a lot of us have seen these things. So is this a trendy kind of thing, or is it real? I would say real. You would say real. But is it trendy, too? Is it something that people are just into?
I don't think so. I think it's a concern. It's an issue. And it's not something that people are going into because it's, you know, it's the hot thing of the time. And there's a, you know, look at the Arizona incident recently. All of a sudden there was going to be an investigation, and then all of a sudden there wasn't going to be. So I don't think it's, you know, it's people's imaginations or...
By the way,
I think it's either something that we're doing or it's in the terms of what our military has that we don't know about, or it's coming from someplace else.
You may be interested in this. The gal who got in a lot of trouble out in Phoenix was Frances Emma Barwood. At that time, she was a city council member. And this monstrous thing appeared over Phoenix, and she had the temerity to simply ask at a city council meeting if they might try and investigate and find out what it was. And she was attacked without mercy. In fact, there was a recall election. She beat it. She is now running for the Secretary of State's office in Arizona. And recently, Secretary of States have become governors quite frequently. The governors of Arizona have not had a lot of luck. And so she is running, and this, Gerald, is one of her issues. She will be the first political candidate in the United States to have as part of her platform open government, more open government, and she will pursue information on what occurred March 13th in Phoenix, and she's actually running on that platform, Gerald. Interesting. She will be the first of that sort in the whole country.
That's wonderful.
She was on just before you came on making that announcement.
Oh, good for her.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Hello, Art. Hello, Gerald. This is Vince in Chicago.
Hi.
You know, Gerald, I'm kind of concerned about the Asian House of Cards. I know as a fact that some of the vultures out there are waiting now for the Hong Kong dollar to collapse, and this might force China to devalue their currency, and presumably this will crack the back of Japan. And I can't see how this cannot affect America. And I know the American people have not lost faith in our stock market yet. They seem to have quite a bit of money in stock market mutual funds and whatnot. But I seem to be the only person who's really worried, and I'm wondering if...
No, you're not.
If I should... You know, I own real estate in Wisconsin. I'm not in the stock market. But I'm to the point where, you know, I've made a lot of money in this real estate up in God's country over there in Packerland. It's appreciated quite a bit, but I think it has appreciated a lot because of how well the stock market has done. I bought this real estate back in 1991, and I have a feeling it's gone up so much because the stock market's gone up a lot. But I worry that a lot of the stuff going on in Asia might hit our economy, and I'm wondering, you know, what you think is going to happen financially.
All right, well, let's attack that. Gerald, I, too, am concerned not so much about what's going on right now, although it is serious for Asia, but if the back of Japan should be broken, Japan, of course, has bought and holds a very great deal of our debt. And if they suddenly need money and take their money, then we do have a problem, don't we?
Yes, we do, Art. And let's also remember that Asia is the world's, Japan is the world's second largest economy. So how can we possibly believe that if the world's second largest economy goes under, it won't affect our markets? And as Vince pointed out, there's this emotion out there that this stock market, the currency crash that swept through Southeast Asia, is not affecting us, our market, and that our, you know, the fundamentals are strong. We've all heard the same stories. Here's the scenario that we're developing. We believe that we're going to see a lot of volatility in our stock market this year. The downside, we estimate, before it all stops, is going to be between 25% and 35% off the 1997 highs.
Well, I'll tell you not to listen to the, for example, Robert Reich was interviewed the other day on CNN-FN. I watch that a lot. And he was asked about the effect of the Asian crisis on the American economy. He said, a quarter, maybe a half percent less growth. Otherwise, not much effect.
Well, you know, I've been surprised, actually, at some of the things that Robert Reich is talking about. He was talking also about the Social Security problem and showed why it wouldn't be a problem because of our continued growth, GDP growth. And I don't know where he's coming up with these numbers. You know, a year ago they were calling this a Nirvana economy. Remember that one? The new paradigm.
Oh, yes.
Remember that one?
Yes.
There's no new paradigm. This is a typical boom-bust cycle. The cycle has busted. And you know what surprises me? As we look at this, and this again, you know, I'm not bragging when I say that we forecast this. It's in my book, Trends 2000. All over the world, House of Cards economies built on a foundation of low interest rates are collapsing. And as the economies went down, so did their currencies. And this was written, the book came out, the hardcover, in 19 December of 96. Now, the same people that did not see this coming, all of a sudden, have the arrogance to tell us what's going to happen next. And, you know, this to me is a lot of chutzpah, as they would say. I mean, they didn't see it coming, and now they're saying it doesn't mean anything. You know, it does mean a lot. It means that we are on a very delicate scale right now of whether or not we slip into not a recession, but a depression. And a depression is going to come about. The seeds are already set. Again, current events form future trends. We just look last The last report that came out of Japan in October showed their surplus went up 221%, the trade surplus.
All right, let me take the other side for a second. Look, the market went down over 500 points not long ago. Everybody said it was doomsday. Well, it wasn't. The market came back. The market has had several mini crashes, you know, 200-plus points recently. The doomsayers all come out, and it bounces back. So far, even though it's down from its highs, it's bounced back, Gerald.
Exactly. And by the way, I was on the Cavuto Report, Fox Network, the day of the crash, the day after the crash. I was on MSNBC the day of the crash.
Right.
And what we said was, the market's not going to collapse. This is not a stock market issue. This is a currency issue. The world is awash with cheap currencies, Art. They're not worth the paper they're printed on. That's what this devaluation means. And what devaluation means is that all of these Asian countries now, first of all, their debt, if it was whatever it was, if their currencies went down 50%, their debt increased 50%. Number two, the product that they sell us is going to be 50% cheaper for them to sell to us.
And 50% cheaper for us to buy.
At some point. Yeah. But it's also going to cost us our jobs. So what we're going to have is deflation. And now I know now they're saying, well, you know, a lot of our services are going up. Yeah, that's very true. Services are going up, but you still have to buy product. So there's a deflationary cycle of product. At the same time, we're going to begin to witness a loss of jobs.
So short-term gain, long-term pain.
Exactly.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hello.
This is Dakota Bear in Kugiak, Alaska.
Oh, yes, sir.
You ought to check on Peter Jennings' website about asthma.
Yes.
He found out that asthma and pneumonia have similar qualities.
Of course they
found
do.
Out,
your lungs fill up? Sure they do.
Yeah, and they found out if you treat people for pneumonia that have asthma, it's been an 85% cure rate.
I appreciate the information, sir. That would imply the use of antibiotics generally until something turns into pneumonia or a form of infection. Antibiotics are not effective. And to use them when you're not going to get a good effect is to exacerbate the problem that you were talking about earlier. Right, Gerald?
That's right. We're antibiotic almost to death.
Well, maybe not even almost. First time, call the wild card lines. Area 702-727-1295. Greg, no, you're not allowed to use your last name on the air, so we're going to have to start all over again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Your name is Craig, and you're calling from where?
Salt Lake.
Okay.
In Utah. I've seen, like, some of these things that you guys are talking about, and, like, some of the ships and that. That are, when I was a kid, I used to like to build model airplanes and stuff, and all I know is when I look at some of these craft that are flying around, they're not dependent on airflow for lift, you know, and
yes,
and
we
stuff.
Know.
There's, but not just that, just a lot of weird things going on in the.
And there's more and more of it. Yes, we know.
Yeah. Do you guys believe in prophets and stuff like that?
Do you guys believe in prophets? I interview prophets. I listen to prophets. Do I believe prophets? I don't know. How about you, Gerald?
I would say the same thing. I don't know. They say in the Bible, by their fruits you shall know them.
In other words, they also, I think, declare that unless a prophet is 100% accurate, that they are not to be listened to. But I don't know how you determine 100% accuracy without listening. Listen, I have promised the audience, I know you have a newsletter, and you certainly have a book. Is your book available? What is the name of your book again?
The book is Trends 2000.
Is it available generally in bookstores across America?
Yes, it is. All right.
It is. All right. When we come back, we'll tell them how they can get a copy of your newsletter. Gerald Celente is my guest. Trends 2000. Trends generally is what we're talking about. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Today, Gerald, you've got a newsletter as well. Tell me a little bit about your newsletter.
It's a quarterly, Art, and
okay.
We look at the major trends that are shaping the future in business, politics, science, the economy, consumer, environmental. And it costs $185 a year, or we have an introductory offer at $99. And our 800 number is 1-800-25-TREND.
That's 1-800-25-TREND.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Apparently a very, very valued newsletter. How long have you been producing this?
Since 1991.
Well, quite a while. Do you keep track of predictions that you have made based on trends that you have observed? And if so, what track record do you have?
Well, you know, our track record is published in our newsletters and, of course, my books. You know, we miss from time to time. What the most difficult thing is the timing of trends. We usually see them coming quite accurately. But attempting to get the exact timing is really tough. And some of the misses that we've had, well, gold is one of them. You know, we can't tell, for instance, what central banks are going to do. So we look at the conditions and we expect the price to go up. But, you know, there's manipulation, just like there's claim manipulation in the silver market from speculators.
Sure.
Well, there's manipulation in the gold market from the financial end and the central bank. So that kind of thing you miss on. But, you know, I challenge anyone to come up with a forecast that we did in calling this currency crisis over a year before it happened.
Good enough. All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Jackie in Colorado.
Hi, Jackie.
And I'm in the Pikes Peak region.
Yes.
In the shadow of the mountain.
Yes.
And in the last month, we have had two incidents that have been explained in local media as meteors.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard about these?
You bet I have, dear.
It's been interesting.
Returning space junk, meteors. There has never been this kind of rash of entering objects. A big one came down in Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
One came down over the Seattle area. Something big, space junk, they said.
Well, they haven't found anything.
I know that.
From these.
I know.
And they went, there was a huge boom from the northeast end of the city, which is Black Forest, all the way south in a matter of minutes.
I've got a million messages from people in Colorado.
About this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is what really ticked me off on it, and I kind of went, wait a minute. In the local news media, someone from NORAD was quoted as saying they don't track this type of thing. They have no information on it.
Well, lucky us, huh?
Lucky us. Yeah, grew up out here, it's like, wait a minute, this is different from what I've been hearing for 30-some years.
I think meteors, large asteroids, that kind of thing, that hit Earth, I think that it is true to say that the one that's going to get you is the one that you're not going to see.
Probably.
And,
I agree with that.
And as a matter of fact, thank you, as a matter of fact, generally what you hear in the media is, well, you know, the Earth really had a close call the other day. And you hear that about 2 or 3 days later, after they have seen this thing passing Earth's orbit close by, a close miss, and you hear about it later. But there have been an unusual number of meteorites or things entering our atmosphere. Have you noticed that, Joe?
Art, that's something I'm really not familiar with.
Okay. Well, I am, and there have been. I don't know what kind of trend that means. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Gerald Celente. Hi.
Okay, I heard that beep, so I know I'm on. It's Kathy from Woodbridge, New Jersey.
Hi, Kathy.
All right. There was a great meteor shower in early December right on to the 19th, and I saw it. And I never in my life saw anything like that. I'm 43. And I must have saw something like close to 60 meteors in less than 2 hours.
Wow.
And I reported one large, round, white ball, which looked like it was, looked like I could grab it like a baseball. And it circled, arced over me and disappeared, and it was around the same time that the thing hit in Greenland. But they tell me that it wasn't what I saw.
That you didn't see what you saw.
Yeah, I saw something like a round, small meteor, but it was nothing, was not the one that hit Greenland because the time does not coincide. It was 2.03 a.m. going into Sunday, December 15th.
Gotcha. Do you have a question for Gerald?
Okay, my question is, I am big on herbs. I would not like my herbs to be taken away from me.
Oh,
are
yes.
the pharmaceutical companies going to cash in on this? Is the FDA ever going to, like, exploit them and make it impossible for me to get them, or are they going to become very big?
Damn good question. Gerald, there have been raids on health food stores, all kinds of strange things going on out there. There have been attempts to actually outlaw many vitamins and nutritional supplements, that sort of thing. It's getting really weird out there. What's going on in the health area?
Right. There was the UN, and I'm trying to think of the... I just threw a blank on it, that they were trying to... Kodak. Was it
Kodak.
Is it Kodak, is it?
I think it is, yeah.
It's something like, yeah, and that was defeated recently. But here's the thing with the pharmaceutical companies. They won't get into something that's not proprietary because it has to be proprietary or unique that they could patent so that they can make money on it. So they're really not interested in...